Hello, and welcome to episode 83 of Desi Books, news and views about Desi literature from the world over. I'm your host, Jenny Bart. Thank you for tuning in. In today's Desi Craft Chat, we have Kalyan Raman discussing his latest Tamil to English translation of Vasanthi's novel Breaking Free. We also discuss how he chooses the works to translate, what drew him to translate this novel, how a translator brings all their learning and experiences to their translation work, how he sees literary criticism and translation work as connected, and a lot more. Kalyan Raman is a translator of contemporary Tamil fiction and poetry into English. Over the past 25 years, he has published 13 volumes of fiction and translation by important writers such as Ashokamitran, Devi Bharati, Pumani, Perumal Murugan, Vasanthi, and Salma. His translations of contemporary Tamil poets have been published widely in journals and anthologies in India and abroad. His translation of Perumal Murugan's Poonachi was shortlisted for the inaugural JCB Prize in 2019 and nominated for the National Book Foundation Award in the US in 2020. In 2017, he received the prestigious Pudumaipithan Award for his contribution to the cause of Tamil literature through his translations. He lives and works in Chennai. Vasanthi's Breaking Free is set against the rising clamour for India's independence. It is a nuanced and thought-provoking story of three generations of women and the effects that history and memory and secrets have on their lives. Kasturi and Lakshmi are born into the Devdasi clan. While Kasturi thinks of nothing other than the joy she experiences when she's dancing before the deity in the temple, Lakshmi is troubled by the treatment Dasis receive from society, the secretive manner of her father's visits to their house, and his reluctance to acknowledge her publicly as his daughter. To the surprise of those around her, instead of learning to dance, a frustrated and angry Lakshmi insists on getting an education and becomes a doctor. As their paths diverge, the differences in their opinions cause a rift in Kasturi and Lakshmi's relationship. But when tragedy strikes, Kasturi's faith in tradition is shaken, and she finds herself turning to Lakshmi once again. Brilliantly translated by N. Kalyan Raman, this novel brings Vasanthi's Tamil masterpiece to an entirely new readership. On a personal note, I've been a fan of Kalyan's work, both his translations and his literary criticism, for years now. And a disclosure, he reviewed my debut translation last year in India. But certainly his own works speak for themselves, and we featured this particular novel in our last Desi Books review, which was issue 3, where we included Vasanthi's introduction, as translated by Kalyan, and his own afterword. And both are definitely worth your time, so please do read them. They'll be linked on the website. And here's Kalyan now. Hi, Kalyan. Welcome to Desi Books and to Desi Craft Chat. Thank you for coming on to discuss this new translation.
Hi, Jenny. Thank you for inviting me on
yes,
the podcast.
Thank you. Yes, it's been a long time coming. We've been trying to decide when we can talk, and you know, we knew that this book was coming, and so that was good that the timing worked out. And it's out in the world now. It's been out about a month, correct?
Indeed, no, about a couple of weeks in the market, yeah.
Oh, couple, okay, yeah, yeah, right, because it came out last month, and yeah. So, you know, the focus of my questions with you as the translator are going to obviously be around the translation. And let's start right off the bat with, you know, translate. There's obviously many metaphors and analogies for them, but they're also seen as curators because, you know, we choose certain works to translate and to bring them to a wider readership beyond the original language. And translation, at least in my case, is also an act of recovery. It's an act of reclamation and appreciation. So with this particular novel, what was it about Breaking Free that made you decide it needs a wider readership? I need to make sure more people read this. What was it, the story, the style, the writer?
Okay, let me talk a little bit about how I choose the works that I translate or why I choose them. The first thing is that I need to see them as, you know, significant in a literary sense, you know, in the sense that I don't want to do a novel which will disappear in the next 6 months. You know, I would like whatever I do to endure or to have reasons to endure, you know. So I generally look for works which have something new to say or which have something new to reveal and which are of enduring value to a particular milieu, okay? So that's how I have done all my, this is the principle of curation, you may want to say. So it has worked out fairly well for me. And as far as this book is concerned, I've been sort of exposed to the debate about Devadasis. I mean, there's a kind of ongoing debate in the Tamil milieu and perhaps in the larger arts and culture scenario in India, where there is a history, you know, the Devadasi system being abolished, you know, or there was a movement to abolish the Devadasi system before independence, and a set of people actually transformed or modified their dance to what is now known as Bharatanatyam, and you know, the politics of it. There's a lot of controversy over it, and you know, there are some people who say that the Brahmins appropriated the dance form and you know, they sanitized it and killed right. The erotic sense and so on. So I've been you know, following that debate close, although it's a very stagnant debate, you know, both sides chucking stuff at each other. Whereas this book came along and it was published in 2012, and I think Vasanthi gave it to me in 2013, and I read it, and I found that this was the first time that the subjectivity of the hereditary dancers, the Devadasis, was dealt with. You know, I hadn't seen it earlier in any work of fiction. And you know, there is also the fact that, you know, by the time I came into the world and I was growing up, the Devadasi system had been, you know, the community had been more or less erased from the public sphere. You know, there were some great Carnatic music, you know, exponents like M.S. Subbulakshmi and M.L. Vasanthakumari and so on. They were from this community, but it wasn't known. I mean, their identity was erased, more or less. So there was nothing, you know, the general public didn't know about this community at all. And it was, this debate came about maybe in the 90s or so in academia, and then it was picked up. And so this book was like a breath of fresh air to me, in the sense that it dealt very honestly with what their lives had been and what their subjectivity had been and what their relationship to art and the kind of devastating effect that the abolition or the transformations, you know, affected on their lives had on succeeding generations of the community, and so their mental agonies and so on. So
I think that was important to me. I think as I was reading as well, it was, you know, the fact that Vasanthi has three generations in this novel, and you are seeing the generational impact. And I think it's fascinating what you say, because you know, you do mention in your own afterword there about a couple of other books, fiction,
that
exist. And I know of one of them, but I you're right. For me, this book was immersive for the main reason that I knew very little about the subject matter. And so I was like, this is a whole new world. And you know, you just mentioned a moment or so ago about how Vasanthi handed the book to you in 2013. And obviously that's because, well, you and Vasanthi have worked together before. You've translated another book of hers. And so this is not your first time working with her. And so, you know, although, as you rightly said, what draws you to the work is the enduring value or the nature of the topic. What is it like to return to work, you know, on an author that you've translated before? And I know, again, like Perumal Murugan too, you've translated, you know, more than one of his books, but, you know, is it easier going back? Do you feel like you already have a sense of their voice and style, or not necessarily, I mean, or does that not hold true when you're translating the same author's work again?
Well, I think that every text is different. You know, I started my career translating a lot of Ashokamitran. I think out of the first five books that I translated, four of them were by Ashokamitran. But you know, during that process, I learned that every text is different. And you have to, as a translator, you have to engage deeply with each one of them in their own terms. Knowing an author or being used to an author is always good. You know, it kind of, you know, you translate from, you know, from the sense you developed of the voice in the text. And knowing an author, kind of knowing in the sense that, you know, it's very hard to know anybody really, but having an impression of what they're about or what their concerns are, that informs your reading of the text and of your translation. But, you know, the experience can be very different. For instance, Perumal Murugan in his short stories is very different from his from Perumal Murugan in his novels, because he writes in a very different way in the short stories. So we really have to deal with the text. The text comes first.
Text comes first.
But familiarity with the author definitely helps. Yeah, it's not.
Yeah, and you know what's interesting, as you were saying that, I do recall that, you know, in her own afterword, Vasanthi wrote about how you got involved, you know, with the narrative and the characters of the story. And that, you know, just before when you were talking about how you had read about the Devadasi culture, do you, when you pick up a project like this one, do you tend to read around the books that you're translating so you can understand the subject matter, especially something like this one, you know, because it has this historical context? So do you tend to read around the books while you're translating, or is that just something that you think, okay, you know, I'll get to it organically, or do you have to read around the books, I guess, is my question.
You know, I want to say this, you know, it is not widely known, but a translator actually brings all their learning and all their wisdom and all their experience to the process of translation. So they bring a lot. I mean, they bring as much as a writer does, actually. So in a sense, one doesn't choose a work that one is not already prepared for in some ways.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, you know, I wanted to say, recently I read the memoir of Gregory Rabassa, the translator
of
Garcia Marquez. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I was astounded by his academic background. Actually, he was working in Colombia, and you know, he prepared himself in so many ways. I mean, not only reading the text, reading related, traveling to the countries, you know, where the text was situated, to understand the politics. Amazing. Mm-hmm. So I do think that, you know, you can't be good as a translator if you don't prepare yourself in some way.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, for me, my first translation, as you know, was Dhoomketu. And that's partly because I'd grown up hearing about him from my mother. So I felt like, okay, it's a given. I'm going to have to do it, you know? So yeah, I hear you. I feel like I've been preparing for it, you know, without really knowing it.
But so, having said that, you know, Vasanthi gave me the book in 2013, and I think we signed the contract for the translation in 2015. So there was an unconscionable delay on my part, you know, for various reasons to get into the project. I finished the project maybe 7 years after I had, you know, signed the contract. But it was in that period that I reflected and thought about it. I kind of developed a relationship with the text, you might say. So it does take me that long, you know, to, and I read, you know, the books that I mentioned in my afterword.
Mm-hmm.
And I spoke to people and, you know, sort of turned over those questions in my mind. So there was that.
It is just like writing a book. You have to kind of get into that mode of saying, okay, I'm interested enough to commit several years of my life to this project.
Yeah, and you have to develop a certain conviction to the, you know, about the material.
Yeah, I agree. So let me ask you, I mean, so Vasanthi has a very particular writing and storytelling style, and I found it a little different between her short story collection, which had just come out last year, and then reading this translation. So for you, what was something particular that you worked to make sure that you were capturing and bringing across in this translation? Was it something about her voice? Was it the emotionality? Was it something else? Or did you feel like it was just natural and organic and there was nothing that you had to really work hard at capturing to bring across?
Okay, the most important thing is that this is a novel by a woman about women of, you know, different generations, okay? And therefore, I didn't assume that I could get into it automatically, you know? I needed to, like I said, develop conviction about various things. I mean, what is it, you know, that Maya, the narrator of the story, is an academic, and she's a descendant of this community, but she's removed from it in some way. And she has these parents who are detached and who are sort of caught up in their own views of the world. And, you know, she's kind of left alone, you know, sort of emotionally adrift. And then her mother dies. And you know, her whole, her attempt to come to terms with this death and finding out what lay behind it. That's something, I mean, the emotional impact of that as described by Vasanthi is something that I had to think about a lot and you know, to make it sound, you know, real.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, if I just took the sentences and translated them, it's probably, and particularly that scene where she gets lost in the forest.
Mm-hmm.
And where she gets the idea of the labyrinth. So that is the metaphor. So that is something that I had to work quite hard about. And then the second thing is the link that she makes between the independence movement and the aspiration that it represents, and how the people of the Devadasi community, certain people, you know, how they read those aspirations into their own lives.
Mm.
You know, their own future.
Yeah.
That's another thing. Of course, she can't, I mean, there's a paragraph just talking about it, another Sarambit one, but there's a lot of build up to it, right?
Right.
They go through the praxis of you know, joining, you know, marches for freedom and so on.
Mm.
And that praxis seeps into their own lives as artists. And you know, their condition, so to speak, and it kind of changes their outlook.
Yeah, I you know, again, as I said, I came to Vasanthi's short stories before I even read a novel of hers. And what I, you know, obviously a short story is on a much smaller canvas. You don't have as large a cast of characters. And with this novel, there is a larger cast of characters and there are different voices. So you've got this, you know, there's a lot going on in certain scenes, and you mentioned a couple of them. So what, I guess when you're in the original language with certain scenes like that, I find it hard just even as a translator. I mean, I haven't translated as much as you, but when I'm doing scenes like that, where there's a lot of people, I find sometimes that things that are said in the original language sometimes are very easy to understand because of the way that, you know, speech tags, say, for example, or certain idioms or terms of address, right? And then when you bring them over into English, those things are not as clear. And I end up finding myself having to make changes that I, you know, changes to, in, to a certain extent, changes to the original text in a way, just so the English reader can follow what's going on in a scene that's got so much, so many people and so much action. And so that's just my example of there, you know, scenes and sections that when I'm translating, I have to spend more time with. So in your case, was it those scenes that you mentioned, or were there any other particular scenes that you felt, you know, you had to spend more time with because they were technically not as easily transferable, if you like, from the, you know, original?
I mean, the novel was strewn with such passages. You know, for instance, there's the passage about, you know, dawn breaking in the Dahi street, and you know, people sweeping their front yards, and you know, there's music, and they draw the rangoli in front of their house.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I mean, that is something that is written with a certain passion in Tamil, right? Mm-hmm. Because it is observed and it's very real.
Yeah.
But to render it in English and with the same conviction, it takes time. Mm-hmm. And I also wanted to say, one has to do a lot of tweaking to even speech and dialogue and so on. One has to do a lot of tweaking in order to make it sound, you know, plausible in English and convey the same meaning, or the same tonality, if you will, or, you know, the same emotion. Mm. It's the kind of thing that you do all the time. You start to any particular scene, because, you know, these are the characters are people who, you know, from the beginning of the 20th century, right? Mm-hmm. In a rural setting and so on. So you have to sort of make them intelligible to a contemporary mind or contemporary reader.
Yeah, right. Because you're moving across time, and you've got all these different.
Yeah. But that's something you do organically, instinctively. Mm. But that is actually the process of translation.
Right, right. I mean, it's part of it, but I think there's, you know, I ask that as a leading question because it's something that I grapple with too on a daily basis in my work, and I know that. When I read the text, when I read Breaking Free, I was reading it like, oh, that sounds interesting. I wonder what he had to do to it. You know, I was like, I wonder what you had to do from the original as you brought it into the English, because I guess I was reading like a translator. And so I was finding scenes, many scenes like that, as you said, the book is strewn with them, which doesn't make it a straightforward, simple translation, but it's all the more, I guess, satisfying in that sense then, right?
Yeah, and the challenge is not to erase the origin, you know?
Correct, right, right.
Erase the source, yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
You still have them sounding like Tamil people in rural Tamil Nadu in, you know, in the beginning of the 20th century.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So, Let me switch gears on you now just a little bit, and I want to talk a little bit about your translation journey, how you came into literary translation, because I know you had, I mean, you and I've talked a little bit before, but you had a whole other career before this. You even lived in Ahmedabad, Gujarat for a while, and so to what extent, I mean, as this became your second career, to what extent did that past life experience and the multilingualism shape or influence, you know, your approach to literature and to translation?
Yeah, I think living in different parts of India, and talking to people and interacting with them, it certainly taught me that things can travel, you know, that artistic or cultural expressions travels quite well and quite deeply. For instance, once I was on a road trip with some of my colleagues who were Gujaratis, and suddenly I found one of them or a couple of them reeling off, you know, Urdu shares after shares. It was quite amazing, you know, that something I never realized. That this cross-regional, you know, appreciation for something that originated in our world or whatever. And it resonated, you know. Usually they share about, you know, disappointment and love or you know, they are maudlin and they are, but they are very passionate.
Right.
It resonated with the guy who was reciting them. And there are many, many such instances of people reaching out to other cultures and imbibing them, you know. So the way in Ahmedabad, for instance, there's the Darpana Dance Academy, which, you know, we taught Bharatanatyam and, you know, stuff that I had grown up with, and, you know, and people were relating to that as well. So in the sense that living in different parts of India actually taught me the, you know, not just the multilingual environment, but the plurality of cultures in India and how people were receptive. And this kind of the belief that in this possibility kind of, you know, that gave me the conviction that literary translation was something worth doing. And also there is a you know, although these, you know, Gujarat is very different, urban Gujarat is very different from urban Tamil Nadu. In certain ways, they also shared many commonalities.
I mean, I think urban India does. Yeah, I think because there's more commonality across urban cities now because of technology. And also, I think the younger crowd generation travels is more mobile, right? They're traveling and working and studying in different cities. I think the mobility of the younger generation also makes a difference.
No, but there are deeper commonalities like, say, patriarchy or, you
know. Oh, of course. Yeah, that too. That too. Now, so you talked about, you know, the plurality and the openness of people to that plurality as well. When you translate, are you translating for a particular English reader? Do you have, like, someone, do you expect that, okay, this whoever's reading my translation will have some familiarity with the culture? Or do you say, no, I'm going to blank slate, I'm going to, so in other words, I guess I'm asking, who do you translate for? Do you have that in mind, or do you not even think about that?
Frankly, I don't, because my focus when I'm translating is in producing a text that'll give literary pleasure, as it were, you know, whatever that one takes it to be. So I'm only interested in, you know, in writing, even other forms of writing, I have a certain objective or certain aims, which is to be as precise, elegant, you know, use of words in an appealing way.
Right.
There is a certain aesthetic which can't be verbalized, right?
Right.
All that, you know, all that which will make the text effective. I know that if I do all that, which will make the text effective. So I try to do that. And this transport of cultures and all is part of it, you know.
Right.
So when I read something in English, I read what I've written in English, I would know whether it communicates well or not.
Mm-hmm.
And I would sort of follow my instinct and change that if it has to be.
So in other words, I mean, your ideal...
to realize that, you know?
Yeah. No, but that sounds to me like your ideal reader, first and foremost, is yourself then, right? You don't have an external reader in mind. The standards, the aesthetic standards are the ones that you've set as a reader yourself.
Yeah, right. And hope for the best, yeah.
Right. No, but I mean, that makes sense to me. I do that with my own writing. Yeah, and given that you're a reviewer as well, you even review translated works. And so you're looking at your own writing, I'm sure, with a bit of a critical eye. So let me talk a little bit about the literary criticism side as well, because I do personally, I see all of that connected, you know, the translation and the criticism. But do you think, because, you know, both require that kind of close reading, right? I mean, you as a translator, you have to be such a close reader at the sentence and word level. And as a reviewer, it's a different kind of reading, but it's still a very close reading. And one of the things, and we could have a whole, I'm sure, separate 1 hour conversation on the challenges around reviewing literary translations. But, you know, as both a translator and a literary critic, what are some things that are important to you when you approach your literary criticism work as well?
Well, I mean, I got into literary criticism, you know, much before I even thought of becoming a translator, because, I mean, I had a reason for it, which was that, you know, I started off as a fiction writer and I wrote in Tamil, and I wrote some essays and so on. But what I felt, because I had a sort of a technical background, what I felt was that, you know, I had a severe case of imposter syndrome, and I felt that I don't know what literature is, because, you know, I don't know how it works. I mean, it's okay, I can string sentences together and I can write, but, you know, I want to understand how it works. And therefore, I did read, you know, your F.R. Lewis or Plekhanov, or, you know, the Marxist question of socialist reality and so on, you know, the debate that were going on at that time. And I did come to some understanding of, you know, what role that art in general and the literary art in particular played in society, or how it functioned in society, and so it is in, and how a work of literature can be looked at, you know, across time, across space, across context. And this excited me very much. You know, I look at book reviewing as a creative attempt, if you will, to derive some meaning, you know, that even lies outside the text that you're reviewing. You know, you place it in a tradition, you place it in a historic moment, you place it in relation to other books. So this is what I find exciting about literary criticism. I mean, that is one part. As far as reviewing translated literature is concerned, I mean, I think that people who review in English, a lot of them, they don't seem to be sufficiently engaged with the source culture.
Mm.
I mean, they don't seem to be, I mean, the people who write only in English.
Right.
So, I mean, this is something that, so because you need to have a very alive relationship with, you know, I don't know how to put it, the wellsprings of where Indian literature comes from.
Mm.
You know, the society, what's gone through, its conflicts, its predicaments, its cruelties, whatever. It's so I think that's what I bring to reviewing translated literature. I mean, that I'm able to see it in its own terms.
Right, right. Yeah, and that's a very important point you make about, you know, a reviewer having or being sort of, you know, tapped into the source culture. You know, for Desi Books, you know, we have a quarterly review issue. It's fairly new, but I try to make sure I'm doing a good enough job matching, you know, a reviewer with a book, because that you get that wrong. And even if the person is a good reviewer, they may not do justice to the book, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, that's a very good point. And especially when it comes to translated works, because they are so specific, you know, from a specific milieu and a specific culture, they're not written in the Anglophone world to begin with, which is a little different. So yeah. So coming to talking about you know, the way literary culture works. I wanted to ask you a little bit about the literary translation ecosystem, because I think you and I have traded some tweets here and there over the years on it, and things have changed, obviously, in the few years that I've been in the biz, you've been around longer. We just saw Anjali Shree and Daisy Rockwell win a big international award for a South Asian language for the first time, which is huge. We're seeing more women writers like Basanti being translated. You've translated Salma too. And I guess, you know, 10 years ago, I don't think it was as common to see that. That said, there's still a bit of a language pyramid in India, right? Where certain languages or works from certain languages do get translated more, they're more visible because there are more translators in those languages. And again, there are all kinds of reasons going back to education system and class and whatever. But, and also I think now the translator's visibility is better than it used to be. We do get our names obviously on the books, but the financials are still not great. So I guess, you know, not to rehash everything, but I, from your point of view, what are a couple of the biggest positive changes that you've observed, and then what might be a couple of things that you think, you know, those could be improved on, they could get better?
Okay, among the positive changes, I would say the foremost is that people are no longer suspicious about translations. You know, there was a time when by default they assumed that that translations produced by Indians, the so-called L2 translators, were simply dross, you know, unreadable, full of mistakes, you know, grammatical and otherwise, and, you know, just junk. I mean, you know, this is the default assumption. And therefore, even if you were good, you were patronized, and, you know, there was all that. I think that has changed. That has changed a lot. But I still think that the respecting the translator as a creative individual and respecting their contribution we still have some way to go. I would think, you know, it's not, you know, there is, you know, in the ecosystem, if you look at, you know, you have the publisher, they represent capital and they're gatekeepers. They are, you know, they are in some way arbiters of the quality of what you do. And there are, you know, the authors who are, you know, who have their own cachet. At least they have they have a territory in the language community for which they write, right? But translators are, you know, they are nowhere. You know, they are literally the subalterns.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny you say that, because I was talking to Rita Kothari when I interviewed her, and, you know, I had asked her a similar question, and she said translation is still not seen as creative work, right? Yeah. It is creative work. And she says, she tells, because she teaches, right? And she says she you know, people, young translators that she teaches or comes across, you know, when they ask for advice, she actually says to them, when they'll say, oh, I'm just doing translation work. I said, don't say you're just doing translation work. You know, she corrects
them. I certainly won't say that.
Sorry?
I certainly won't say that.
Yeah, no, you wouldn't. But I mean, you know, the younger people, because again, I think it's because it's not valued that, and so they don't think they're doing something, you know, creative. And I totally agree with you. I think the number of times I get told, or people will say, oh, you know, because they happen to be bilingual or they happen to be multilingual, and, oh, you know, I can speak these languages and I would like to be a translator. And I'm thinking, well, you know, just speaking or knowing another language doesn't necessarily make you a translator, because there's a few other skills that have to come into play. And not that you can't learn them, but it takes time. So that's something you
think. I should add something here, which is that even now, over the past maybe a couple of decades, I mean, well-meaning friends would regularly tell me, why don't you do something on your own? You know, you know, this translation is other people's work, you know.
Yeah, so then why don't you write your own? Yeah, I hear you.
I mean, there's more glory or whatever it is. So, I mean, I never bought that really, but.
Well, but I mean, in terms of the marketplace, in terms of the capitalist marketplace, it is, you know, the author's work is valued more than the translator's work. That's just unfortunately, you know, yes, these are two related texts, but they are both texts in their own right. You know, it's funny, I'm currently reading Daniel Hahn's translator's diary. It's called Catching Fire. It came out this year. And he kept a diary while translating this novel. And it's funny how, because he's going through his process of translation, but he's also talking about how much work it is and how creative it is and how much satisfaction and joy he gets from it. And I think people don't see that. Some people still don't see translation as kind of this work in its own right. So yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, I would think that, you know, this happens also because the translator cannot speak. You know, there have been very few avenues for translators to talk about how they work, or you know, it's of not much interest. I mean, publishers talk all the time about how they work.
Right. Yeah. You know, and that's interesting because I've brought on a lot of translators. Again, it's because I'm a translator and I feel it's necessary. I brought on translators on this podcast. But what's interesting is that in India, while yes, some translators are being interviewed and, you know, but it's usually when they've been shortlisted for something or, you know, the book has gone a little further ahead in the public, you know, visibility. And then people start turning around saying, oh, wait, who translated that? You know, like what happened with Gitanjali Shri and Daisy Rockwell. I mean, that book had been sitting there, not really getting any attention, quite frankly. And then suddenly, because of the booker, it's everywhere, right?
That's true.
Yeah, which is a shame, because that tells you, I mean, as I think as Shri said, you know, the book happened to be in the right place at the right time. And so it managed to get there. But there are other really good translations from India or from South Asia that don't get as far, but they're just as good. And we've, you know, not given them their due attention. So
yeah, you know, what you really need is you know, robust, high quality discourse, you know, literary discourse on translation. But that is hardly ever encouraged. I mean, because you need to fund people to do it.
Yes. This comes back to, we talked about before, a Writers and Translators Association, like say, for example, ALTA, you know, the American Literary Translators Association here. I mean, they do a whole conference or festival every year with so many panels and so many discussions, and we don't have something similar. You know, we don't have a seminar or conference just dedicated to translators, right? Yeah, that's something to work on at some point, I guess. Let me switch gears and come to Tamil literature in particular. And I haven't read a lot of it. I've read Vasanthi, obviously. I read that Salma book that you had. I've read, because I interviewed him, Thomas Hitoshi Pruksma did Thiruvalluvar's Thirukural. Right? He translated that, but that's from the classic Tamil, right? I mean, that's like very old Tamil, but I mean, I read some of that and interviewed him. So I guess what I'm saying is, we know Paramamurugan, we know Salma, we know Vasanthi, we know a few others, but we don't know who are the few must read Tamil writers. And so you know, tell us a bit about what are the big milestones and who should we be reading? Who else should we be reading in English translation?
Well, yeah, first of all, I want to say that that what has been translated into English from modernist Tamil literature, which is about, you know, 80, 90 years old, is just a fraction. And so there's a lot that is untranslated still, or not translated very well. So there is that. And this makes the life of a translator very easy, because there is an embarrassment of riches, you know, to choose from. So there's that. But if you want to look at what is translated and available, I would say that Ashokamitran is definitely a must read, because not just because I've translated a lot of it, others have done it too. I think it's the 18th and translated by Gomati Narayan, and Water by Lakshmi Holmstrom, and Manasarovar, which I have translated. I think these are, you know, extremely good books. I mean, and you know, there are also collections of short stories that he's done, which are also phenomenal.
Hmm.
I mean, he's a special writer, and you know, you know, the reader would find out, you know, when he explores. Well, then again, his Tamarind History is it's a classic. There are, you know, there is G. Nagaraj and Tomorrow's Another Day.
Mm-hmm.
So there are quite a few. I mean, I'm not able to, I don't want to randomly quote works, but yeah, there are at least about, you know, 15 or 20 books that I can recommend, but I would rather do them in a more considered, you know, way.
Yeah, no, but I think you've given us two or three, yeah. important names that we don't talk about as much, because, you know, when I think of Tamil literature in translation right now, I think of those big names, Perumal Murugan, Salma, Vasanthi, because those are the big names that are, you know, it's recency bias. But those are the names we know.
Pumani is definitely he's one of the great writer of his generation, mm-hmm. whom I have translated, you know, one of his novels is Heat. Mm-hmm. I may be doing more of in the future.
Yeah.
There is Devi Bharati, who's also very good.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I've done a collection of his called Fabel Mahatma.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think Heat, I know. I haven't read it, but I do know of it.
And one more very leading writer is mm-hmm. Jayamohan.
Okay.
And, you know, the first collection of his stories in English called Stories of the True is being published by Jagannath.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And that's quite a powerful collection, I think, in the pipeline.
Oh, okay. So let me ask you, I mean, so talking about pipeline, have you already started your next project? Do you know what you're going to be working on next?
Yeah, I'm halfway through my next project. In fact, I hope to finish it in a month or so. This is a novel by Devi Bharati called The Solitude of a Shadow. It's about a person obsessed with revenge and what it does to him.
Hmm.
It's a subaltern story which takes place in the Kongu region, the same region as Murugan. And it's quite brutal, actually.
Oh.
You'll see it, yeah.
So it's, I mean, it's already got a pub date and everything. Is it coming out next year?
I'm doing another contract. Yeah. The contract was signed a long time back.
Right. Yeah, I mean, most translations.
This is the last of the delayed projects. Yeah.
Ah, okay. Yeah, most translations, we do them only when we contract, because it's too much work otherwise.
Yeah, and I'm working on a couple of poetry collections. And one of them is nearly complete. The others, I hope to complete it this year. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I forgot to ask you about poetry, because I remember you shared that one poem one time. I forget what I'd asked, and you shared it on Twitter, and it was beautiful. It was I'm trying to remember what it was now.
Yeah, that's a little known secret about me, that I've translated quite a bit of poetry and published quite a bit of poetry.
I was surprised. I mean, I was surprised in the sense that we had never talked about it before, but I don't translate poetry, because I'm afraid I don't think I'll get the musicality or the rhythm. I feel like I maybe need to translate 5-6 books and then maybe I'll try. But yeah, that you had shared that one, and it was a beautiful poem.
Was Slaughterhouse. I think it was called Slaughterhouse.
Yes. Yeah.
Balati Maitri, yeah.
Yeah.
And a lot of my poetry translations are available online. I mean,
right. Cool. Well, I do have one last question. And I ask this of everybody, this doesn't have to be a book in translation, but which is your favorite Desi book and why? And it's hard to pin down on just one. So it could be what you last book you read and you really liked, maybe, but and as I said, it doesn't have to be translation, but if you could just share with our listeners, you know, a favorite Desi book and why.
The Big Home by Jerry Pinto.
So I'm trying to remember, it's based on, it's his mother, I think, if I'm remembering correctly. So it came out, it was first published, according to the description, it was first published by a small press, and then Penguin, I guess, republished it.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't know this, but yeah, I read the Penguin edition, yeah.
Hmm. And so so the mother has bipolar disorder, and that has an effect on the kids. And then the story is, if I recall, the story is actually told from the child's point of view.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I think we don't get enough of those novels, right? We don't get the adult novels, but told from the child's point of view. Mm. We don't get those in India as much. Or if they're maybe not done.
What about mental illness?
Yeah. So, I mean, so what was it specifically that you liked about this novel? Was it that point of view? Was it the fact that that was kind of an original for that reason?
Yeah, I thought it was the story was told with a lot of dignity and balance. And it was also harrowing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it is quite a feat to balance all these elements and make it into a, you know, story. Which it wasn't seeking sympathy or anything like that. It was more, this is the way it is. Yeah. Mm. So, you know, there's a line by Hanif Qureshi which says that we're all recovering children.
Yes. Well, very well said. Yeah.
So this was an illustration of that. I mean, if you go back, even Arundhati Roy's Got a Small Thing,
yes. This,
mm-hmm. yeah, is again sort of resonates with that statement. So
yeah, it's fascinating. It's, you know, you have to wonder that book came out, M and the Big Whom again came out almost 10 years ago now, right? Almost 10 years ago.
Yeah. Probably more.
Yeah.
But it won the Hindu Prize, I think.
Oh, it did. Yeah. So it did get recognition. It definitely.
Yeah, it definitely recognized, and I think that is, many people have mentioned it as an important book.
I think it's one of those books that I feel like I've read it, but I know I haven't. I've only read excerpts, and I need to go and read the whole book, but I've read so many excerpts. I feel like, okay, I know that book. But then as you were talking, I was like, oh gosh, I know it's about
depression. I don't think an excerpt will do justice to the book.
No, Okay, well, that's a good, and I'm going to put that one on my list because I keep meaning to get to it because I want to read that child's point of view and how Jerry's done it. And he is a good writer and a poet and a translator. He's just all rolled into one, right? So that's a great recommendation. Thank you, Kalyan. I really appreciate that. And with that, thank you. This was, I mean, we could go on. I know we could go on, but I will need you to get on with your day. And I appreciate you making the time to discuss Breaking Free. All the very best with your books, Jeremy. Yeah, all the best. I mean, it's only been out a couple of weeks. So yeah, it's still got a ways to go and, you know, make its way in the world. And we'll be sharing more of your words and Vasanthi's words in the upcoming issue of Books Review. So I'm looking forward to that.
Thank you
for that. And we'll be talking. I'm sure we'll continue talking about translation issues on Twitter then.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
You've been listening to episode 83 of Desi Books, news and views about Desi literature from the world over. I'm your host, Jenny Bhatt. Thank you for tuning in. Today's Desi Craft Chat was with Kalyan Raman discussing his latest Tamil to English translation of Vasanthi's novel Breaking Free. We discussed how he chooses the works to translate, what drew him to this particular novel, how a translator brings all their learning and experiences to their translation work, how he sees literary criticism and translation work as connected, and a lot more. Episode 84 will be up shortly. Follow on Twitter at Desi Books, Instagram at Desi.books, and Facebook at Desi Books FB. Tag the accounts if you have requests or suggestions. And please go to the website if you'd like to sign up for the free weekly newsletter. That's desibooks.co. And please share this interview via social media so we can keep raising the tide of Desi literature. Stay healthy, keep reading, and write well.